On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
Well, we're getting a rare privilege here. I'm getting a chance to interview somebody that I actually get to see face to face. Most of the interviews on the Bookshelf are people I'm talking to from a long distance, but we're delighted to welcome Dr. Chris Schaefer, who is the Dean of Library Science at Troy University, and he has written a book about his experiences a few years ago over in a country far enough away from what's normal for us that I think makes for very interesting reading. And the name of the book is Moon Over Sasebo: One American's Experience Teaching in Post-Cold War Slovakia. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the Bookshelf today.
Thank you for having me. It's a mouthful if you do the subtitle, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. So, how did you get this opportunity to go to Czechoslovakia as it was breaking up and becoming the Czech Republic and Slovakia, and you ended up in Slovakia, correct?
Correct. 1991, and I was a senior at Auburn. Summer quarter was my last. I needed 8 elective hours to get out of there. Auburn's hottest place on earth, except maybe Troy,
yes,
in the summer. And so they had an abroad program to Germany. And I could finish up there. I had a minor in German. It seemed like that'd be a lot more fun than staying in Auburn. And I don't know how they came up with the price. It was going to cost me $300 more to go to Germany as opposed to stay in Auburn.
Wow.
And I will point out, it wasn't my money, it was my grandmother's. So, but I was getting her a good deal. And one weekend, I went over to Prague, just fell in love with it. It's just a beautiful city, lots of tons of Gothic, also a good bit of Baroque architecture. Decided I wanted to go back. And so I go backpacking after the 2-month stint in Germany and went back there. And found a sign on a telephone pole that said, you want to come over here and teach English? And you just ripped off a telephone number,
mm-hmm,
got back, and it was an organization called Education for Democracy, but it was out of the University of South Alabama. So how's that for weird?
Yes, indeed.
Or coincidental. And so I had a degree in pure history. I needed to go get certified to teach, which I did. And by the time I got over there, Czechoslovakia had dissolved when they overthrew communism. It was called the Velvet Revolution because there were so few deaths.
Right.
And the separation of the country was completely bloodless. It was just paperwork, bureaucracy,
right,
and that was called the Velvet Divorce. So I got there 14 days after Slovakia became an independent country, and I'm always honest. I was trying to get back to Prague, but they sent me to this medieval town called Banská Bystrica. Sasava is a suburb where I live.
Okay,
and it's just this beautiful mining town historically, and just loved it. Had a great time.
You were sent there to teach English to people who had never really been exposed to English much, had they? I mean, during the Cold War, if you spoke a second language in any of the places behind the Iron Curtain, Russian would be the smart language to learn because those are the people that were kind of in charge. You were teaching people who had they even been able to see television with English speaking on it, or were they were just hitting this language cold?
Well, keep in mind, so in terms of technology, it's a different era.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
mm-hmm,
like today, if it's some kind of dictatorship, there's still a chance that a signal's getting in and you're watching something online.
Right.
Back then, and I will point out, the students I was teaching were conversational level. So they were like third-year students, because I would have no idea really how to truly teach someone from the beginning. But in general, English and German were not the preferred languages because they were the languages of capitalism,
right,
and the languages of democracy, neither of which were in vogue with the Soviet Union.
Right.
German, you would kind of get more because you would have people who, it's close.
Right.
Austria is close. Germany is close.
Right.
So that would happen some. And so I could get by on my mediocre German. I was a much better beer drinker in Germany than I was a student. So Hefeweizen's, highly recommend. The odd Western language to me, and it's not odd at all, it makes sense, I was just ignorant, French was quite common for a Western language.
Interesting.
Language of diplomacy.
Right.
So, and of course, the Slavic languages do have a lot in common,
mm-hmm,
and so everybody could speak Russian, which didn't do me any good.
Right.
Because that was their second language. But, like, if you went over there and you were conversant in Russian, mm-hmm. nobody would have spoken to you because they might know how to do it, but they had been forced. It wasn't the
right.
second language of their choice,
right.
and they did not care to speak it.
I was in Russia in 2009 with a music group, and we would get on a bus and be just normal Americans, you know, making racket, making jokes, smiling, laughing, waving at people and stuff. We noticed that nobody looked at us. Everybody had their heads down. And we finally asked our interpreters, you know, are they just upset because we're Americans? And she said, oh, no, they don't really believe you are Americans. They think that you are KGB pretending to be Americans to try to trap them into saying something like, yes, we're glad you're here. The Soviet Union sucked or something. And so that's why. And I found that everywhere I went in Russia, even in those days, there was that feeling of we still don't really believe that everything's gone away that we are used to for our whole lives. There was kind of an element of that in Slovakia even then, wasn't there? We're not really sure who in the government we can trust and so forth.
Each country sort of had a variation in terms of how – strict is the wrong word, how evil the government was.
Mm-hmm.
And the governments were all evil. There's no doubt of that. But like, you know, Romania is an example of that was everybody was a spy.
Right.
I mean, family members were spying on family members.
Right.
And, you know, Ceausescu, that was one of the ways I got interested in that part of the world is I can remember being 19 years old on Christmas Day, opening presents with CNN in the background because we were watching the Ceausescus get executed.
Right. I remember those days, too.
And, I mean, they were purely evil, and it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to avoid saying cool. But now, in Slovakia, while they were – in my experience, so I'm not going to try to talk about what things were like
sure.
with other people that I didn't know or before I got there – I found the people to be very open, very trusting
okay.
of me, at
yeah.
least. Now, sometimes, because I've got a big mouth, I would say things and, you know, they would sort of push back a little bit.
Right.
And, you don't say that stuff out loud.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah.
And so, yes. You know, it was there, but it was, in my experience, not horrible. I think if I had been in Romania or Bulgaria, which had a notorious secret service,
yeah.
and they were always colluding with the KGB, you know, I think it might have
yeah.
been a bit of a different experience. And of course, to your point about Russia in 2009, well, it turned out they were right.
Yeah. Sad but true.
Slovakia really has... continued to pull off a pretty healthy democracy,
mm-hmm.
Things can happen. And, you know, they had a horrible incident a few years ago where a couple of journalists were murdered.
Right.
And you always have to sit back and wonder, so are the bad days about to come back or what's going to happen? And everybody, because it turned out there was government connection to the murders. And they were all voted out, and they were investigated, and people had been prosecuted.
Yeah.
And they, although the prime minister is the most powerful person, they have elected this wonderful young woman, Susana Kapitova. She is just very liberal, very passionate about democracy.
Right. I find it very interesting. I've gotten to go behind the Iron Curtain a lot over the last couple of years, except during COVID, of course. But it's very interesting meeting people there, and they're so happy that they're not under that thumb anymore. But they always know. I mean, these are people that have been overrun for centuries. You know, there's always been somebody willing to invade them. So they don't take that for granted. And that's one of the things that's kind of reminds me that we've really had it pretty doggone good here.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the incidents you were in line for food or something and just forever, all day long. And you got back and said something to a person who had become a friend of yours about, well, I think I understand communism now. And she sort of set you straight. But you did the typical American thing, you know?
Yeah, we think we know everything.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, we've had this horrible day. Now we understand,
and,
you know, decades of oppression.
That might have been a little bit arrogant, but the grocery stores in Slovakia were tiny. I talk about in the book, you know, there
right.
was just, there was one of everything. And actually, when I've had people from Western Europe come to the United States, maybe less so today, but say 20 years ago, Walmart blew them away.
Right.
Because it was like, why do you have all these choices for the same thing?
Yeah.
But like in Slovakia, it was not cornflakes or frosted flakes or whatever. It was Knusper flakes with the cute little Knusper bunny on the front, and that's it.
Yeah.
There were no others. Very small stores, and what you would have to do is you would have to wait to get a cart.
Right.
And then you could go in and shop, and then you got to the line, and you got to wait again to pay, and then you went out and you gave someone else your cart. Two things here. First off, it may have just been practical because the stores were small.
Right.
I also think communists like lines because it tied up your day.
Right.
And it is soul-sucking. I mean, if you're having to stand out waiting on a cart for 20 or 25 minutes, you know, in 20 or 25 degree temperatures,
right,
you're not really thinking about how the government's being run.
Yeah.
Although, actually, you should.
that should be the time.
Someone's making you do this stuff. Yeah. And so in the book, where I get so ticked off is all I wanted was a Coke. So, you know, I had to wait forever and then take this cart that I didn't even need just to go get a can of Coke and then wait again. Like, we have these really cool machines in the United States.
Yeah,
you put a couple of quarters at the time in, and you're set. And so I go and talk to this friend, a good friend, and said, you know, I just understand your plight. You know, I understand everything y'all have gone through since 1948 when these guys took over. And, whoo, she got mad.
Yeah.
And and said, you know, I'll tell you what communism is or was. Communism was getting a knock on the door at 6 a.m. And, a neighbor says they've got bananas or apples at the grocery store. And you go stand in line for 3 hours hoping that you can have one piece of fruit for each member of your family.
Right.
And I was like, well, that sucked. And you know, I apologize because it was just arrogance.
Yeah.
But, you know, I really was, I was a history major. I'd read about this stuff.
Sure.
And I was just trying to figure it out. Reading and being quiet might be a good. The Slovaks have a saying that I've always tried to live by, which is, you know, someone's intelligent based on how quiet they are.
Hmm.
Which you could also say, if you keep your mouth shut, no one will know how stupid you are.
Right, right. So. My dad used to say, two ears, one mouth, not a design flaw. We are talking to Chris Schaefer, who is the author of Moon Over Sosova, One American's Experience Teaching in Post-Cold War Slovakia. It's published by Hellgate Press out of Ashland, Oregon. And is it available online and in bookstores and all that?
It's available on the press website. It's available on Amazon. And if you happen to be stopping by Cedar Rapids, Iowa, it is in the National Czech and Slovak Museum store and library.
Wow, that's very cool. Now, you were there 6 months?
Yes.
Yeah. So when you first moved in, you were staying in an apartment, and this was also a welcome to post-communist Eastern Europe. The places that were offered to stay were pretty small, and you didn't have a refrigerator. But it didn't matter because it was freezing outside.
Yeah, so you used the balcony. And as things go, I mean, it was a very functional apartment. It was two bedrooms, and you also had a little den area. And then a decent-sized kitchen just for – I had a roommate, Merrill. And who's also a teacher. And so the kitchen was fine for the two of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't doing a lot of cooking anyway because,
right.
I mean, it's just sort of your European nature in general. You tend to go out.
Right.
And prices, particularly if you were an American, were unbelievably reasonable. Half-liter beer was – I keep coming back to beer.
Well, it's an international symbol, so I think that's okay.
Yeah, but 33 cents equivalent for a half-liter of premium beer.
Wow.
And Slovaks do. They make some of the best beer in the world, so that was great. You could probably have a 3- or 4-course meal for about $5.
It reminded me very much of the first time I went to Cuba in 2004, where our money – was trading at such a higher rate than theirs that really you could get an enormous amount of food for just a couple of bucks, and so much so that you couldn't eat it all. Even Americans couldn't eat it all, and we had to figure out, what do we do? We can't throw this food away. There are people in this country that are literally starving in the streets. We cannot throw this away. But the host, in our case, we were there with the band, and they're responding to our sponsor of our trip. And so they said, well, we have a big refrigerator. So it's great. Here's all this. It was an Italian-Chinese restaurant, which there is only one in Havana, by the way. How many hours a day did you teach?
Not many. I mean, it was. I'm trying to remember. Do I say in there?
I got it marked.
I mean, I don't know that I was ever on site for more than about 6 hours in a day. It was 24 hours a week.
Right.
24 hours a week. Yeah. So, and I guess the rest of the time would have been meant for planning or whatever. But yeah. I only had two courses that I was two groups that I was fully responsible for. Otherwise. I was like a co-teacher, and so I go into the room. The teacher would have assignments that she wanted me to do with the students, and I would just do it. So you don't have to prep for that I mean, I am fluent in this stuff, so I could handle that.
You mentioned going to Prague one time and seeing Dixieland bands there, and this reminds me that my experience has been that I often travel with a jazz band. Everywhere we go, people are just dying to see it. You know, here comes an American jazz band. And it's so interesting because in America, you know, if you were to sell tickets for a jazz band concert, you'd probably have to give a lot of them away. But overseas, jazz is a huge export of America. But there was also kind of an extra tinge for it, or a bonus, if you will, for the folks that went to see a Dixieland band or a rock and roll band, for that matter, in that little tiny act of rebellion.
It was, because jazz is abstract and all things like that by the communist totalitarian leadership was viewed as bad. You know, what do you
suspect.
Mean abstract? In the same way as the Nazis and all of the artwork.
Sure, art as long as you do it the exact way we want it to be done, then you're fine.
And so it was just a very slight way, easy way of saying, you know, screw you, government.
Yeah.
And that band, and there's a picture of them in the book.
Yeah.
You know, they were out on the square in the old town playing. And years later, there's this one super fancy restaurant. I'd always go past it. And you couldn't afford to eat there. And then finally, in I guess 98, I went there and actually went in, sat down and ate. And that same band was playing in there. And they spoke bad German, and I spoke bad German too. And I was able to explain to them about seeing them, you know, over the years on the square. And I just thought it was so great that I got to catch up with them again. They talked to me for half the night. They were super nice.
How cool is that? I think one of the things that really stuck out to me is that there was so much beauty in this country. Apparently, and was Prague an open city during World War II? Did it not get bombed particularly?
It was not bombed.
Yeah.
To my knowledge. I mean, I'm sure somewhere a bomb must have hit. But in general, once, you know, the West gave away the Sudetenland, that was all the defensible territory.
Right.
And so they were put in a position where about all they could do was just surrender and then go underground.
Yeah.
And the Czechs and the Slovaks had a very active resistance.
Right, right. It seems to me that being in a place like this so soon after the fall of the Soviet Union was just an extraordinary opportunity. And the fact that you had the chance to be over there and experience it all had to have had quite an impact on a young history student.
Well, it did, and I used it in my classes for years, because I taught history for about 8 years, and I got to go beyond Slovakia. I mean, I went to Krakow, Poland, and we went to Auschwitz.
I've been to those places too.
That's horrifying.
That's a sobering visit going to Auschwitz.
There's a certain amount of freedom in all of this that, you know, Well, I had it a few times, but I was lucky. But you don't have stuff like this many times in your life. But Meryl and I show up at the train station, and we're trying to go to Krakow. And we were just always jinxed on that, although we finally made it. But we got to the train station maybe 2 minutes after it was supposed to leave. I mean, like 12:01, we're there at 12:03, and the trains did run on time.
Yeah.
And, you know, he looks at me and says, "What do you want to do?" And I look at the board, and in about 5 minutes, there's a train leaving for Budapest. And I just said, "Yeah, I've never been to Budapest." And he said, "Neither have I." And we just went and got our tickets and got on the train. You know, I had the best guidebook in the world, Let's Go, for all of Eastern Europe. And,
right.
You know, on the train overnight, I just found us a place to stay, and we were set.
And Budapest is such a beautiful city also. And they did get some bombing. I think the chain bridge, I think, was destroyed by Allied bombers.
Yeah, but the bastion, that's completely faked. You know, it's just rebuilt.
Right. But it was such an old and beautiful city. There's still plenty of stuff that's the original equipment.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Parliament building is one of the most incredible things I've ever seen.
Right.
But, you know, there are cities you can go to, and there's something that just doesn't feel right about them. Mm-hmm. There's just a lack of authenticity, and I'm thinking about Warsaw, Poland.
Mm.
And, you know, I found out while I was there – 85% of the buildings were destroyed.
Right.
And so, they're doing the best they could.
Yeah.
And the Russians, the Soviets, did not have a great interest in rebuilding them with top of the line materials.
Right. That good old traditional Soviet concrete.
So, well, you know, I mean, the square itself, you know, it looks like an old square, but there's something that just doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah.
Now, Dresden in Germany, of course, now talk about places where the Russians truly had no sympathy, and, you know, at least I understand. But that was one of the best civics projects I've ever heard of. But they basically took, because the Russians were not going to rebuild them. And, you know, Dresden was a war crime.
Right.
We knew.
Yeah.
There was no reason to bomb it. We flattened it.
We were testing napalm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was payback.
Yeah.
War is not all smiles and roses, you know, whatever. And so anyway, but they took the original stones to the extent that they could. They put them in piles, and then they would raise money to rebuild with the original stuff. And I think it was in like 2007 or 8, it was the maybe 800th anniversary of Dresden, and the Frauenkirche was supposed to be reopened. And I'd always hoped I could go back and see that, because I'd seen the work in progress on a fellowship in 03, none of which has anything to do with what we're talking about.
Right.
So,
but
sorry.
No, that's okay. I mean, isn't it amazing to go to a city that's been around for so many hundreds of years? And I'll never forget the first time I went overseas and saw a building that had a little teeny weeny placard that said, "It's celebrating our millennial anniversary," you know. And I thought, we'll put a plaque on the building that's been around for 50 years and think, wow, this is really great. This is an old building.
We're impressed with ourselves.
Yes, indeed.
But, you know, you can go up to New England and see things that are, you know, 300 years old.
Right.
Stuff like
that.
That's a big deal. 400, maybe. And then you've got St. Augustine.
Right. And I grew up down the road from St. Augustine, so we would go up there quite frequently, and they really do have – that's the oldest continuously inhabited city in the United States.
Right.
I was in Mexico over the summer and visited the – in Morales and visited the oldest university in the hemisphere. It was founded 40 years after Columbus landed.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
so
interesting.
Even that, when you go to Slovakia or any place in Eastern Europe where armies have ravaged for centuries, that's still pretty new.
Oh yeah, and Charles University in Prague, you know, it's 1100s, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's an astonishing thing, isn't it, to get a chance to visit places like this and to it humbles you as American, and it's okay for that to happen, for us to think, hey, we may be the newest thing on the planet, but we're certainly not the oldest thing on the planet. These guys have been dealing with life the same way we do for a very, very, very long time, and we can learn from them.
But then you can also learn from their stupidity at times.
Yes.
Because if you look at Yugoslavia and the breakup there.
Yeah.
Slobodan Milosevic was managing to trigger all these people into wanting to kill their neighbors over the outcome of a battle that happened, I believe, in 1390.
Yeah.
Those dang Ottomans.
Yep. Yeah. And we're gonna have revenge. It's been a long time coming, but we're gonna fix those. The descendants of those yeah. Ottomans, the Albanians. To me, one of the things that was so nice about reading your book, so we can get back to the book, is that you talked about the velvet divorce between Slovakia and the Czech Republic. That's not what happened in Yugoslavia at all. That place broke out. It was like taking a hammer and dropping it on a glass plate. And I've been there recently in Serbia and Croatia, and they're still celebrating the fact that they've just rebuilt buildings that had been destroyed by the war 20-something years ago.
Oh, yeah. And I think that war could come back very easily.
Easily.
You know, in the book, I believe, on that trip, I went to Slovenia. Mm. And we didn't tell our parents that we were going because it actually was quite safe. I mean, the war was over there. It was only like a 10-day war in Slovenia.
Right.
But, I mean, if you told mother in 1993, hey, I'm going down to Yugoslavia, you know, that wouldn't have gone over.
Yeah.
Beautiful country, nice people, had a great time. And I was talking to someone when I was there, and I said, how did, you know, Croatia's lost at that point about 70% of their territory.
Right.
How did all of you manage to escape this? And the guy said, well, what do you think you do when you secede from a country? And I was like, I have no idea. And finally I said, because I actually thought about our founding fathers, I said, right. Well, you celebrate. And he said, that's right. And the Croats got drunk. And they said, so they stayed drunk. They partied. This is one guy's story in a bar. So
right.
If it's not true,
right.
Forgive me. But if there are any Croats listening. But he said the Slovenes didn't party. They secured the military bases. They set up outposts, and they were ready. And when the Serbs tried to invade, they hit them.
Yeah.
And then you had a separate issue of the whole reason, supposedly, the Serbs were wanting to take all this stuff back was mm-hmm. to protect ethnic Serbs in those territories.
Right.
Slovenia was about 2% Serb. And so after they successfully repelled them, they decided to go after the other people who were not quite as prepared.
Yeah. Echoes of this, even today, between Russia and Ukraine. The territories that have always been desired or opportunities for the breadbasket of Eastern Europe and so forth, these things don't change much, do they?
No. I really can't figure out what Putin's point is. I mean, he was very entrenched as dictator of his country.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he thought he was going to gain here, but
if the Ukrainians would just welcome him with open arms,
yeah.
and then he certainly would be ignoring the very real history between Ukraine and Russia over mm-hmm. the last couple of centuries.
And now he's in a position where, like Biden said a couple of weeks ago, how do we find an off-ramp for him?
Yeah.
Because he's got to somehow not lose face
right.
To mixed cultures. And I mean, he's just gotten his tail handed to him, so
yeah.
I don't know what that looks like.
This kind of reminds me of the way things were going with Afghanistan when Russia invaded Afghanistan, the Soviets invaded
yeah.
Afghanistan, and it ended up being the last straw, basically, for their economy and for their people.
Right. It was a humiliating loss.
Yeah, yeah.
So
be interesting to see. But in the meantime, if you want to get some insight on what it was like to go into Slovakia— back when they were learning how to be a nation again, when they were learning how to be a people and learning what democracy was really all about and the opportunity to think for themselves and not to be concerned about oppression or anything, this is the book to read, Moon Over Sasava, One American's Experience Teaching in Post-Cold War Slovakia from Hellgate Press, and it's from Dr. Christopher Schaefer. And Chris, thank you so much for joining me today on the bookshelf. I've enjoyed our discussion very much, and I enjoyed your book a lot, too.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our thanks again to Dr. Chris Schaefer, author of Moon Over Kosovo from Hellgate Press. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.